Hello, everyone, and welcome to part 2, episode 3 of Deeper Grooves, Musicians on Music, sponsored by California Soul Music and hosted by Cliff Beach. Very excited to have part 2 talking with Mr. Mike Clark. He's going over the information on one of his latest albums, Live at the Iridium, called Indigo Blue, featuring such great artists as Christian McBride and so many other great musicians. Very excited to have him back once again from New York. Please help me welcome Mr. Mike Clark.
You're always constantly trying to keep pace and continue to still be modern and still relevant. And so as you look into what's next and having such a long career, explain to us like what motivates and excites you and why you're continually still putting out new content.
Well, I think what really motivates and excites me is like I'm a fairly high energy drummer, like in an electric big fusion band. I wouldn't sound like I'm a high energy drummer because in there, that's way more than what I do. But in a jazz band, I would be considered a high energy drummer. Uh-huh. So when the band's really swinging hard, and there's some interesting arrangements, and there's some places where you can really communicate to the others, and they're communicating back, where it's a dialogue. Not like I'm backing somebody up, but an actual dialogue where we're all communicating, and it's swinging real hard, like a hard velocity swing, and like dirty swing, man, like really funky swing, and really burning. I think that's what that and really excites me and makes me feel like playing all night effortlessly, and also playing blues. If there's guys who can really play the blues and really make you feel it, that's also excites me. I'm very interested in that all the time, you know, and I feel that's the base of the whole jazz thing anyway. And so without that, the music, when it gets into the brown rice thing, that's not my area of expertise. So those are the things that really knocked me out. Like, I really like going to the club or to the concert and playing with a powerful jazz group that really has some great arrangements and addresses what's going on now in our world. The artists, the picture that all of us paint, are dealing with what we're feeling and seeing going on in our environment. So that's I've already been credited, and I'm grateful for it, for an innovation. So I'm not trying to invent anything new. The act of many jazz musicians who I know are the art of playing the music, just the act of playing the music. It doesn't matter if it's an old standard or a new original, or if it's jagged and out and bashing, or if it's just quiet and swinging, or if it's a beautiful ballad. If the chord changes are beautiful and it's real jazz music, I think that's what most of us live our life for, is those moments. And then, of course, if somebody can write something that's going to change the world or going to change the way people are, you know, every once in a while you catch a vision of what could happen. And if you get lucky, like I got lucky, that's what happened on Actual Proof. I had a vision of what rhythms would sound like tomorrow. And I was right in my and I was able to record it, and it influenced many generations of guys. And I kind of knew if I was going to be able to record something along those lines, that it was going to have that impact. You know, I just knew that it would. It wasn't egotistical. I could just hear what had happened before me. I could hear what was going on at the time. And at that point in my life, I could hear where things were going. I was pretty convinced of that. And I guess I was right, you know.
It's definitely something that you're well known for, and you influenced a lot of drummers, as you said. And I've heard it said that the first Velvet Underground album didn't sell many copies, but everyone that heard it went off and started their own band. So is that what you wanted to do, to inspire others to play?
I wanted to make a contribution, yes. I wanted to make a contribution to the music because I felt that if I could do that, that would be one way of me possibly paying back a debt of gratitude that I felt down to my bones for all of the joy that of the music that I felt and been a part of, and been able to make a living as well. Right out of high school, I didn't go to college. I went to work, and I've been working ever since. And I very seldom missed any work. And so I wanted to give that back, if there was a way to give that back. And the way the story goes, I guess I did, by what happened with actual proof, as it encouraged a lot of people, and people built their drumming. A lot of drummers, their drumming was, that was part of the, that's part of the language that they stood on to come to build their thing. Like I stood on the shoulders of Philly Joe and Max Roach and Elvin Jones and Tony and Roy Haynes, those guys, Art Blakey. And then the next wave stood on our shoulders, Harvey, Lenny White, Billy Cobb, and me, several other guys. And so I feel fortunate that I was able to have that experience. I was at the right place at the right time. I was lucky, but I was prepared, you know.
Yeah, so you definitely were, talking about your origins, traveling out with your dad and playing with people. It sounded like you weren't nervous at all, and it's always better to prepare and never have the opportunity than have the opportunity and not be prepared. So then what would you give advice for like an up-and-coming musician starting out now, either in drumming or jazz or music in general? Like, what would you tell them?
Well, I've taught at a lot of colleges, and you know, I've been a clinician at a lot of colleges, so I have an idea what's going on. I don't teach at any one school continually, but I a lot of them, you know, over the years. And so what I see is my advice would be to get all the experience you can playing with other people, playing arrangements with other people, playing music that you love with other people, because just being in the practice room and developing technique is not how this music, it's not what this music's about. I mean, there is, yes, you have to become a master of your instrument, so there is some of that, but it's not all of that. You have to learn how to swing, and you have to learn how to play the blues convincingly. You have to, and the only way you can really learn all that is by playing with other human beings, you know. And so I always say, get all the experience. If you're in college, yes, do your assignments, of course, but take all the time you can to go play with other people and learn how they're laying it and how you're going to lay it, and where to put it, where not to put it. Learn the dialogue, learn the dialect, and learn the nomenclature, you know, lexicon. Learn the language. Once you can speak the language fluently, then you can play with anybody, you know. And I also tell guys, don't just learn your favorite thing. Learn what they did in the 50s, what they did in the 60s and the 70s. Learn, stay on top of the history, so that the more history you learn and have under your instrument, the more people you can accommodate and make feel good when you play with them. So you can, this way you can cut a lot of different kind of music, and you're not stuck in one bag. Like a lot of time, if you only do your favorite thing, then you have to call your buddies that it's their favorite thing too, and then you play, and then everybody, and you guys have an understanding. But if your understanding is larger than one area of expertise, then the more people you can have in your life and the more opportunities to work and create work for others, and it's a good feeling thing. It's a good people thing. It's a bonding type of thing, because people will trust, this guy loved the music, he did his homework.
No, yeah, you got to do your homework. You got to pay your dues. You have to get out there. You can't just practice in a vacuum. You got to get out there and play with people. So I think that's all really, really great advice. So for my last question for you, I just wanted to kind of get your final remarks and the future for you. I know you talked a lot about a lot of great new projects that are going to be coming out, and I'm sure there's more things that you want to do than time. And when you find the time now, you're probably putting your head around more ideas and new ideas come to you and you just keep going from gig to gig to gig. But if you just wanted to give kind of a final remark, like what is Mike Clark to sum it up and like what's next for you?
Well, I just put a book out called The Post-Bop Drum Book on Hudson Music, and it's doing quite well.
Congratulations.
I wrote all my post-bop stuff in there, and so far, some real high-level drummers are reading out of it and calling me back and saying to me, and I wanted their opinion because these guys can all really play, and they're telling me this is a great book, and you got right to it. You didn't waste anybody's time. And the payoff is in the book. Like a lot of books, they hem-haw around and take you all around the thing that they're talking about, but you don't get a payoff. It's never like, well, here's how you do it. Well, I made sure in my book, like, well, here's how you do it. Now, if you could just play these things and organize what I tell you to do here and then do it your own way, don't do it like I do. And these will be door openers. I tried to give a lot of door openers in this book. So I'm feeling this book that I wrote. I even like to read out of it sometime. And so I did that. And then I have three records that are coming out this next year. Four, actually. And then I'm waiting to see what happens with this virus, how we're going to open up and what's going to happen here, because I lost all my work in China, Europe, England, France, Germany. I lost a ton of stuff. I'm not saying I got to get all that stuff back, but I have to start getting back to that place in my life where I'm working the way I was for the past 20, 30 years. And because all of that brings fortune, good fortune brings fortune. So if you're doing well and you're playing with good people, great people, then great opportunity rises. All of a sudden a record company shows up here, this shows up there, that shows up, you know. So I plan to continue to put forth my vision as a drummer, and I'm getting better all the time. You're able to stay alive and your body is functioning well, you can just keep on, you can keep improving. It's amazing. I see it with all the guys my age, because I've been playing with most of the guys since they were in their 20s, and I was in my 20s, and I see what's going on. Man, everybody has really, really moved way up as far as performance go. So doing a lot of recordings. I'm not sure where the business is going to go, but I'm not worried about it. I'm positive about it. It's going to go somewhere. It always does, you know. And even with this, we'll get through this, and something else will open up, and I'm not sure how it's going to go. But you can be sure that I'll be one of the people that are involved, however it goes. You know what? So... And right now I'm giving lessons, private lessons on Zoom. I've done a couple of clinics. I'm not having anybody into my house right now. I'm doing it all online. And I have a couple of other clinics that are coming up to promote this book. And then I'm going to start this record with Michael Wolf and Leon Lee Dorsey and myself. Should be out in July. And so look for that. And I'm looking forward to it because we took Beatles tunes and we made them all swing. And it's I love listening to it. It's fun, you know. And right behind that, we have one with the great Harold Mayberg, who's passed away, brilliant jazz piano player, and Leon and myself.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of, you know, you're keeping a breakneck speed of getting that content out there. And I love that you're, you know, moving into the digital age with Zoom and master clinics and stuff. And I think that will be a part of the future, not all of the future, but definitely a segment and a part of it. So I think that's great. I think, you know, continually to constantly improve, again, like you said, as long as your body and your mind are sharp and you're able to do it, why not? I mean, you really don't seem like a person that's going to retire. You're going to continue to better yourself and improve, and you really love your instrument and what you do. So that's really, really great to see and very encouraging.
You know, I play with guys that are in their early 20s and they have all these ideas, and in the same band, there can be a guy 50, 60, 70 in New York, I play, and all of these guys are so modern, and they're such extremists, and they're so well-versed that it's like always, it's always new and fresh. I don't feel like I'm repeating stuff over and over again. I don't feel like I'm in a rut. It's always exciting. And all of these, you know, we don't really subscribe to ageism or any kind of ism. We just all get together. And somebody's writing something, and they need a certain kind of sound, and they'll call me, and I'll know a certain kind of guy that maybe can arrange for them, and we'll call some other guy, and I'll call Essiet on bass, or Gerald Cannon, or some of my favorites. And the next thing you know, we're off and running, man. You know, it's great. You know, so that's the beauty of staying in New York. You're not far apart. You know. Everybody's kind of lives sort of close to each other. The city's not that big. And we all kind of have a feel for who does what. So it's not very, it's easy in New York City to get things done. The industry is here for jazz anyway, such as, I mean, I'm saying this knowing that all these clubs are closed and everything. I just feel something great's going to come out of this. You know, that's how I'm looking at it. And, as we said earlier, I am a Buddhist, so I can't very well be a Buddhist and be thinking, oh, man, this shit is over.
Right.
So it's not that. I can't be that guy, you know what I mean?
No,
so,
no.
I'm looking at forward to a nice future. And I've had a good, I mean, it would be easy right now. I hope I'm not talking too much, but I'll just close with this. It would be easy for me to say, oh, you know what? I hit a couple home runs. I hit a couple of singles. I struck out a couple of times. I got on base. I scored a few runs. I could just go home and watch TV. It'll be okay. I did okay. But man, I have much more left. Fortunately, my drumming is improving, and what I'm hearing is becoming more interesting. So I don't want to stop because I've worked all my life to get to this place, and now things are starting to happen. So I don't want to rest on my laurels, you know, and play the same stuff or anything like that.
No, and I think there's no reason why. I mean, you seem like you're enjoying what you're doing, and you know, every experience is changing you, and every day you wake up, you're a little bit different, and you gain more experience and heard more things and play with other people. And it's just an evolution. It should continue to on a continuum. It doesn't have to stop unless you make it stop, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. And there's a bunch of young cats. I know Will Blades, an organ player out in LA. I play with Will. I have all these hardcore jazz cats here in New York, but you know, I know a guy named Skerrick, a great saxophone player that plays in the jam scene, and he's been a friend of mine for years. I know Will, so I can put together all kinds of different, you know, kind of like small orchestra, like small 4 and 5 piece little orchestra like groups that flirt with the avant-garde as well as just swinging, you know, a lot of stuff that can happen. And I've been thinking about recording in my house, just me, do a chart, and then I'm going to send the chart to the guys, and then they can play. Somehow or another, we can either videotape it by our phones and then show it to people, or we can tape it on our recording devices and make some type of a recording. So I'm talking to about a million guys about this, you know. So,
well, very exciting stuff. Is there anyone that you wanted to play with that you haven't played with, either in the past or present, and people that you still want to play with that you maybe just haven't yet?
There's some guys. Like, I'd like to play with Azar Lawrence. Now, I played with him before, but he played with the Headhunters. And it was a fun gig, and he did great. It wasn't that I didn't enjoy it, but, you know, he's really kind of a Coltrane kind of guy, and I wanted to share some of that with him. I don't want to be in his band, and it's not like I need a gig, but I wanted to play with him specifically because of what he was playing. I'd also like to play more with Nicholas Payton, who I really enjoyed playing with and didn't get to. I need to find out more. I need to hear more and experience more with him in my mind. There's a guy named Jaleel Shah, a saxophone player, who I love playing with. And I've only played with him two or three times, but I already know I love playing with him. So I want to get some more of that, you know. I just started playing with John Davis a little bit, and his music, just the way he approaches his music, tells me I definitely want to do some playing and explore that. So, yeah, there's guys I'm thinking about, you know, that I want to interact with musically, definitely. And I have to wait until some maybe venues or opportunities open up so I can try to create a space to make this happen.
I feel the law of attraction will bring it together. Just knowing what you want to do, the pieces will kind of fall together eventually.
Yeah, I believe in that. I'm with you on that, you know? Yeah, I'm putting that out there. So right now, I read this thing, this Buddhist thing that said, if you care about yourself, you will pray that whatever this is that is causing sickness and death and chaos in our land will dissipate and leave us alone. And I'm entertained. I'm doing that. I'm chanting Nam Myoho Renge Kyo for this thing to cease and desist so we can get back to whatever it was we were doing.
Yeah. Well, there's plenty of work left to do, for sure.
That's plenty of work for us to do, you know. And so I'm doing a lot of self-reflection as an artist and a human being, attitudes that I had that I thought served me well, that I realize now that I've been in the house for 2.5 months and had time to think about it, didn't serve me so well at all. You know what I mean? Like stuff I can, attitudes and ways of dealing that I can definitely do without. And I can see it clearly. That's part of the Buddhist practice, is actual proof is based on your inner reformation. And when you change inside, then the outside changes, the environment changes, and you get your dream, your wish starts to come true. So I've had most of the challenges that I've chanted about as my career have come true, but there's still... It's that you're never perfect, as we know, so I'm still trying to, like when you blow a garden hose out, there's gunk and mud and stuff in there. So I don't think you ever get to a place as a human where the garden hose is perfectly clean and the water's running perfect. You have your moments, but then, so I'm trying to rid myself of what I find unattractive about my life. And I don't have to work my ass off to do it. It's a matter of course when you chant, when you practice Buddhism, it just sort of, and when you relieve yourself of that type of fear, anger, or whatever it is, then benefit, material benefit jumps up in your face because you no longer cut yourself off from opportunity and don't even realize you're cutting yourself off from opportunity. All of a sudden, those doors start to open. That's how it works. And Herbie explained this to me when I was about 23, and of course, I was like, oh, yes, bullshit. And then the other part of me, because I didn't know the damn thing. That's that. That's some bullshit. And then the other part of me was like, damn, that's Herbie Hancock. I better, whether I think it's bullshit or not, I better chant, you know. So I did, you know. And then it started to open up. My eyes started opening up more and more to what was going on in my life. And, and when I could finally see some of the things that were going on in my life, I was able to perceive some of the things going on in other people's lives as well. So anyways, I'm going off on a whole thing here. But
quite all right. But, you know, I really enjoyed talking with you, Mike. Hopefully you'll be able to do it again. I got to tell you, I mean, you telling me that my cover of God Made Me Funky was one of the best you ever heard was such a high honor and really made me feel special. And I'm glad we were able to keep in touch the last few years, and hopefully we continue to keep in touch as you continue to put out great content. Very excited that we got to talk about some of your new stuff that's coming out, as well as some of your previous stuff, especially the Indigo Blue album. I think definitely more people should listen to it. So I can't wait for this content to come out, and we'll circle back to you when it does so that you have a copy of this and be able to hear it and read it. And we're excited about the future for music and the future for you.
Did you know how God Make Me Funky came about?
You told me a little bit of a story, but definitely share it again so I have it in audio. I have it in email.
I'll make this brief, and then I'll cut out. I won't keep this over. All right. Paul and I lived in East Oakland off of 14th Street and between 85th and 86th on a street called Aussie Own. And a lady, Mr. and Mrs. Everett Jones, moved up from Georgia and opened up a little teeny barbecue place on the corner, Everett and Jones Barbecue. And it had only been open one day. And, of course, we smelled all that good barbecue coming if we lived right next door. And the windows were open in the summertime, you know, oh, my God. So we started going over there, and you couldn't even sit down. You had to order and stand up and wait for them to give you order, and then you'd leave. So she heard us practicing over there, and she said, if you fellas write a tune to put on the Soul Station, KDIA, while we advertise the store and the food, we'll feed you for 2 months, ribs, chicken, whatever you want, potato salad, the whole nine yards, you know, greens. Okay. Yeah, because we were young guys. We didn't want to cook. And we get 2 meals a day from her, and you know it's going to be killing. So we wrote right there while waiting for our food. We wrote God Make Me Funky on a napkin. We ran out with our barbecue boxes. Then we went down to Ray Dobar's Soul City, which was about 2 blocks down. We said, Ray, we need to record a tune. He said, come on in, do it. So we called some of our boys. They came down. We recorded God Make Me Funky and then gave it to her. And then she fed us. But then slowly, as day by day went by, we started hearing God Make Me Funky on KDIA radio. And they played it behind the food advertisements. Well, pretty soon people started calling in saying, man, what's that song? It's smoking, man. That song is killing. And that's how God Make Me Funky came to be. And we played it around California. Thousands of people loved it. But then we recorded it with the Headhunters, and it became one of the most sampled drum loops in hip-hop history. NWA, they did all that was God Make Me Funky, like, everybody did it. Everybody was using that loop, and they used the drums. So that's the story.
Yeah, no, that's great drum loop. I mean, that's right up there in the top three of that, the funky drummer, James Brown, and then the Amen Break. So you're excellent company. But, I mean, I love your version. I mean, having the Pointer Sisters on it and Herbie produced. I mean, that's just an amazing record. That entire album, the Headhunter first debut, is amazing. But I'm glad that you were able to share that story with me. I don't think everyone knows that. And unfortunately, there's that original version is nowhere to be found. No one has heard it. But
no, and it's the funkiest of all, because the one that they produced, the snare broke, and it was on Tom Tom. There were a lot of problems. So the guy told me to keep playing, so I played the whole thing on with a snare on Tom, so there's no ghost notes, you know. Mm. And then the producer put the snare drum on top of a wastebasket with a microphone in it, and the microphone picked up the backbeat. The backbeat sounded kind of like instead of a snare. And that was the record. Later on, the rappers loved that backbeat. They loved the sound of that snare, and they have no idea it was defective. But it sounded different, and they liked it. So that's what it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes those happy accidents just happen that way. Serendipity that way.
Absolutely. All right, bro. Well, listen, speaking of barbecue, I'm going to put my dinner on. And
oh,
it was great talking to you. Thank you for calling me.
Great talking to you. And I will circle back as soon as this is done and let you know when it's going to be released. And you'll be able to hear it after it's edited. And we look forward to talking again.
Absolutely. All right, brother. Thank you.
Take care, man. Have a good one.
Okay. Bye-bye. Over now.
Thank you for listening to Part 2 with Mike Clark. Deeper Grooves, Musicians on Music, hosted by Cliff Beach, sponsored by California Soul Music. We would like to thank our guest once again, Mike Clark, for sharing his experiences with us. And I'd also like to thank our engineer, Tim Hall, in 1192 Studios in Westlake Village, California, for mixing and mastering this recording. If you like this recording and you want to hear more, you can visit us online at www.californiasoulmusic.com/deepergrooves. Until then, see you next time.